even in your core business, I think you should constantly think about how is it evolving? Because most parts of your core business, there is opportunity for you to evolve it, right? To modernize it, to put automation behind it, to simplify processes, to digitize processes, et cetera, et cetera.
Hey, gang. How are you? You caught me on a good day. This is episode number 170 of Future Proof. I'm Bill Sheridan. Welcome aboard. We got a great show for you this week. So let's get right on with it, shall we? And we will start, as always, with this. This week's show is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. Okay, so I was scrolling around online recently when I stumbled on a meme that kind of caught my eye. It was a photo of Frank Zappa, which, I mean, right there, we'll stop you in your tracks 9 times out of 10. He is a distinctive looking gentleman, to say the least. But, you know, Frank's mug wasn't really what caught my eye. It was the quote beneath Frank's mug that did the trick. And I did a little poking around, and to the best of my knowledge, you can safely attribute this quote to Mr. Zappa. All evidence points to it being his, which, you know, when you're reading quotes online, you never know, right? But anyway, here's what Frank Zappa said. He said, without deviation from the norm, progress is not possible. Yeah, brilliant stuff there in a really straightforward, simple way. Reminds me of that old definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing and expecting different results. If you want to make progress, that ain't the way. Sooner or later, you're going to have to deviate from the norm, right? And then exactly one day after Frank Zappa showed up in my feed, I started reading this book called Unsafe Thinking, How to Be Nimble and Bold When You Need It Most. And it's written by a gentleman by the name of Jonah Sachs. Great book, by the way. If you follow our blog, take note, I'm going to be writing a lot about this book in the next couple of weeks. Lots of inspiration there, fantastic lessons. But anyway, on page 2 of this book, literally page 2, all right, I read this quote, and it's from branding expert Jason Klein. He said, quote, if you're feeling nervous, that's a good spot to be in. Stuff people expect gets forgotten quickly. On their mental computers, they drag it right to the I've seen it before folder, and then it's game over, right? End quote. So deviation from the norm, thinking outside the box, Frank Zappa or Jason Klein. Look, however you want to look at it, the concept here is clear. If we want to move forward in a world that's changing and becoming more complex, almost exponential, we're going to have to think differently. And that means all kinds of things. Teaching ourselves to think differently, sure, but also teaching others to think differently, knowing when and how to disobey the rules in order to get new things done. All of that is in play here. And this book has a ton of examples about the power of unsafe thinking in action. But the one that I like most and that I think applies mostly to this week's show centers on football helmets, of all things. Okay. In his book, Jonas Sachs tells the story of Richard Schneider, who is a neuroscientist at the University of Michigan. So the number of deaths from brain injuries among football players, that number was climbing drastically throughout the 1960s, with more than 100 players dying between 1965 and 1969 alone. And Schneider was paying attention. He decided that the solution to this horrific problem might be to improve the protective quality of football helmets. And so we got to it, right? By the end of the 1960s, he had radically re-engineered these helmets with more padding, better shock resistance, better. He also proposed a series of rule changes to kind of ban the game's most dangerous and serious head-first maneuvers. And the result of all that was that by 1973, the number of deaths from head injury in high school football players had dropped by 75%. Okay, 75%. That's huge. So mission accomplished, right? Wrong, actually. The improved helmets Here's the weird thing. The improved helmets actually gave players a false sense of security, so they'd go out and hit each other even harder and take even more risks than before, thinking that the helmets would protect them. And this led to more concussions and more players returning to the field more quickly after suffering concussions. And of course, those concussions, while you know not initially life-threatening, they presented huge health concerns of their own for players later in life in the form of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, right? Or CTE. That's a degenerative brain disease likely caused by repeated head traumas. So now where do we go, right? Well, enter into the picture. There's a gentleman by the name of Eric Swartz, a kinesiologist at the University of New Hampshire, who employed a bit of unsafe thinking of his own in an effort to tackle the problem of head injuries in football. And here's what Jonas Sachs wrote in that book, Unsafe Thinking. It's a little long, but good stuff here. Sachs writes, quote, "Helmets do not make players more prone to concussion. Their behavior while wearing the helmets does. Suddenly a fact of nature becomes a problem of human psychology." Swartz went to the University of New Hampshire's football coaching staff with a bold and strange proposal. He wanted to create an experimental group on the school's football team and train them differently. So in drills, they would practice with their helmets off. The plan seemed outrageous, naturally, at first, to head coach Sean McDonald, but still the logic made a kind of odd sense to the coach, who had lost too many of his players to concussions over the years. So he allowed Swartz to recruit a set of volunteers for his study. One of those volunteers was named Daniel Rowe, and he had started wondering if he should continue to play football at all. He had sustained 3 concussions in 3 years and was unlikely to go pro, so he thought logically he shouldn't probably be playing at all, but he was reluctant to quit. So he figured practicing without his helmet was worth a shot. And here's what he said. When you take the helmet off, you're highly conscious. Like, I can't get a scratch, right? You don't want to do anything damaging above the shoulders, Rowe recalled. So the hundreds of tackling drills that he did without a helmet retrained him to lead with other parts of his body and to keep his head well out of the way of impact. And that season, Rowe was concussion-free, and the safer style of play made him more comfortable during games, leading to what he says was his best season in terms of on-field performance. Meanwhile, Swartz's data show that the program has improved overall tackling performance on New Hampshire's football team, while the players in his experimental group experienced 28% fewer head impacts. These are impressive results for a single season intervention, but only a glimmer of the potential impact on the sport if kids start practicing without helmets in youth leagues when their habits are forming and eventually play consistently against opponents who have been trained to protect their heads as well. In 2016, the NFL's Seattle Seahawks began implementing Swartz's program, end quote. I mean, really mind-blowing stuff there. In his book, Sachs calls this counterintuitive creativity, and it starts with reframing the problem. Right. In this case, the problem is not how football helmets are designed, but rather the behavior of the people wearing them. Now, how do we, you and I, start employing a bit of that kind of logic in the problems that we face each day? Right. And interestingly, Sachs says the answer isn't necessarily to practice unsafe thinking ourselves, but to rather first think of ourselves as unsafe thinkers. And there's a difference. Here's what he means. Some research has been done in recent years into how to get more people to vote. And here's what the researchers did. In the days leading up to the election, they presented a survey to potential voters with a question that asked, how important is it to you to vote in the upcoming election? Among people who saw this question, the likelihood that they would vote jumped to 79%. So pretty good, right? Then the researchers tweaked the wording of the question to how important is it to you to be a voter in the upcoming election? Okay, catch the difference there from how important is it to you to vote to how important is it to you to be a voter? 90% of the people who got the question phrased in this second way actually voted, from to vote to be a voter. Huge increase in the likelihood to vote just by tweaking the wording a little bit. So maybe the question for us isn't so much, how do we think more unsafely? Maybe the question should be, how do we become unsafe thinkers? You know, I don't know, food for thought, I guess. And these questions, I just think they're more important than ever, right? In a world that's increasingly governed by disruption and transformation, by innovative new strategies and technologies that require us to think differently and ask better questions. And all of that kind of brings me to today's show and my guest. Geez, I haven't even introduced our guest yet, have I? Well, check this out, okay? He is Pascal Fenette. Pascal is co-founder and chief heretic. Now, that's a pretty cool title. Talk about unsafe thinking, right? Co-founder and chief heretic with Be Radical, which researches, develops, and teaches tools and frameworks designed to transform their clients, that's all of us, into practical futurists and successful disruptors, right? So Pascal's been here before on the show about a year and a half ago. I saw him most recently as the keynote speaker at the 2021 Digital CPA conference back in December, where he spoke about the correlation between disruption and state changes, okay? Moving from one state to another, like solid to liquid to gas, which pretty much describes life for a lot of us these days, right? I mean, we're all in a constant state of flux when it comes to our states and how they're changing. Anyway, we talked a bit, Pascal and I, about what happens to our skills, our processes, our existing strategies when we encounter state changes like this. And there's a lot of unsafe thinking embedded in this conversation, I think. How we have to change our mindsets and ask different, better questions to arrive at solutions for today's problems. So just a really great conversation this week with a really deep and insightful thinker in this space. Settle in. Here is my conversation with Pascal Fenette. Pascal, thanks for being here. Now, this is kind of interesting. You're the second thought leader that I've heard recently talk about, I don't know if you call it a correlation between disruption and state changes. And, you know, as an old boss of mine used to say, when you hear more than one person that you respect a lot talk about a new idea, it's time to start paying attention to it, right? So I guess I want to start off just by having you tell me a little bit more about what you mean when you say disruption is about state changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's good to be on your wonderful show. So very briefly, when we think about disruption, we very often hear and regurgitate these stories of the Kodaks, the blockbusters of this world. And we have got this interesting obsession looking at disruptors. We look at the Netflixes of this world and say, what have they done to be so successful to disrupt the disrupted? And I think we're missing out an interesting insight. And this comes back to, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I got really fascinated by this world of disruption because it's everywhere. There's not a business headline you can't read which doesn't say you get disrupted, et cetera. And really what started for us was this idea to say, what is actually happening? What are the underlying forces? What is the stuff which is happening, which makes a blockbuster, for example, be disrupted? Mm-hmm. And then when you start peeling the layers, and this is where this whole idea and the theory of state changes comes from, what you do realize very quickly, if you just look close enough, is that the underlying consumer need, the thing we are actually hiring a product or a service and thus a company to do for us, those needs don't change all that much on a fundamental level. Mm-hmm. So this goes back to Clayton Christensen, who talked about the jobs to be done. We hire a product or a service to do a job for us. And if you think about Blockbuster, you know, Blockbuster gave us entertainment. They gave us made us watch movies on our home screens. And that underlying need, that desire, has not changed when we went from the Blockbuster, the world of Blockbuster, to the world of Netflix and, mm-hmm. you know, originally DVDs and later streaming. So the important thing here is to understand that the underlying consumer need actually doesn't change all that much over time. Right. What does change is the delivery, the way we bring it to the world. And that's what we call the state change, where you go from one state to the next. And briefly, where we got the idea from is state changes, of course, is a phenomena out of the world of physics and chemistry. If you take water, Water is frozen. It's, you know, it's ice. It warms, it becomes liquid, and then it warms further and becomes gas. The in-between is what is called a state change. And the reason why we think this analog fits so well is because water itself, H2O, in our case, the job to be done has never changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So so Netflix is obviously a great example, one that a lot of people turn to. Are there any that kind of correlate to our profession, accounting and finance, that you can think of in a real world sense in how that has kind of played out?
Yeah, I can tell you out of my own business. Okay. You know, when I started out in business 20 years ago and we did payroll, just as one simple example, you know, I went to a payroll provider who manually essentially ran payroll for me. I paid people to fill out paper forms to then put them on a fax machine to send them, or put them in an envelope and put a stamp on it and send them to the tax authorities, right?
Yeah.
Now, clearly that has evolved. Now, the underlying need for me to manage my people, to make sure that they get paid, that they get their benefits being paid, that, you know, like the taxes are being paid, all of that stuff has never changed. Now, I don't do this today anymore by using a firm where there's actual people, right? Today, it's an automated process. I'm using a software product, which lives in the cloud. So it's not even on my premises anymore. So that is an interesting way of thinking about the state change, where we went from a people-driven business, which was based on paper, to a digital business, which is now in the cloud, which people very rarely even touch anymore because it runs basically on autopilot. And I think if you think about the profession, clearly, I mean, I'm not telling you anything new here, but that's a huge trend we're seeing in the profession for many of the consumer needs as they were expressed or are being expressed yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Yeah, and this is kind of leads to a question which you brought up in your keynote at Digital CPA, but I think a lot of folks in our profession are kind of really keen on right now is this idea of the skills that they're going to need going forward, right? For generations, we've kind of fallen back on the same types of skills, stuff that we usually learned in college and then have come out and just spent decades in our careers kind of working on these skills. And now what I'm hearing is that in an era of state change like this, these skills that we need to remain relevant going forward might be changing pretty radically at the same time that the needs of our clients and customers are not changing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think this is a good, it is an important and a good point, because when you look at why do actually companies stumble over transitioning from one state to the next? I mean, there's a really good argument to be made that, you know, the Blockbusters of this world or the Kodaks of this world or whatever company you want to take which stumbled, they shouldn't have, right? Because they had all the client relationships, they had all the money in the bank, they had all these things going for them. But the challenge is, of course, as you pointed out, their existing skills and processes were anchored in one particular state. So if you think about, and I'm using Blockbuster just because most people can relate to it, Blockbuster's existing skills and processes when they ran their business was essentially about being a real estate company. They had, 9,000 stores all across North America. They knew better than anyone where to put a store, how to merchandise the store, how to run the store, you know, all these processes. Now you go to a world where you move store concept where you rent a VHS videotape to a mail order concept where you get a DVD shipped to your home. And suddenly you realize that existing skill and process, the idea that you know how to run a store and where to place it, et cetera, becomes obsolete. You just don't need it anymore. Now you need skills and processes around how do you run a mail order operation, right? And then clearly that state has changed once more to streaming video, which is another a very different skill set. Mm-hmm. And I think we see this, you know, also in the profession, in the CPA profession, the finance profession at large, that we're moving from a certain set of skills and processes which have served us really, really well for whatever, 30 years, 40 years, to a very different one. And I think the smart firms, the good firms, they anticipate those state changes, they see those, and then they think about really hard, think about what are the skills we actually need for the future, and then start to cultivate them inside of their people, or where they can't, sometimes you can't, they start hiring for them. And I think it's really important for us as leaders to really think about where does the future go? What are the skills we need for the future? What are the processes we need to set up for the future? And then start to reskill and upskill your people.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's something we've been talking about now for a while in this profession. And still seems to be a really hard nut to crack is this idea of, as you said, anticipating, spotting those state changes ahead of time. Is there anything or any advice that you can offer for how we can start spotting these really kind of transformative moments before they actually happen? What should we be doing to kind of prepare us for that?
Yeah, now probably to add to your question here is also there's an interesting corollary, which is this idea that what of that stuff is actually real and what is hype and will never materialize, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, there's a really good question of if you look at the current noise in the market about non-fungible tokens and the craziness we see there, you know, where people sell digital images of, you know, like monkey renderings for hundreds of thousands of dollars. So is that a real thing? Right? Like, is this the future of like art? And thus, you know, do we need to figure out as an accounting firm, how do we account for that? What do we do about this? Or is this a blip on the radar? Mm-hmm. So I think everybody can cultivate a skill set we like to call the skill set of a practical futurist, which is really, first of all, just becoming open to seeing these early indicators of change, what we like to call the weak signals, the thin wisps of tomorrow. Looking at, you know, just reading the paper and becoming, you know, digital paper clearly these days, talking about state changes, but like just becoming curious about the world, saying, okay, so, you know, like there's a bunch of kids, they're called the Bored Ape Club, and collecting weird pictures of apes on the blockchain. Like, what does this even mean, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the first step, just basically becoming like a sponge, becoming, you know, childlike curiosity is a word I like to use here. Sure. Just becoming curious about the world. And then you want to ask yourself some really hard questions about what does it actually mean? What is the underlying thing which is going on here? What is the trend? What is the staying power of this? And, you know, quite frankly, very often, even if you're an absolute like non-expert in many of these topics, I do think that it is not that hard to actually look at something like this and say, what's going on here? You know, is it really about a bunch of kids, you know, swapping and selling, you know, JPEGs, GIFs, pictures, digital pictures? Or is it really about something much more fundamental and underlying about like, how does money get transferred? And what does this mean in our accounting systems? How do we account for that, et cetera? So those are the questions you want to start asking yourself. And I think, again, we all can become a little bit more of a practical futurist if we just start allowing us to not just dismiss. You know, it's very easy to see something like the Bored Ape Club. I mean, even the name, come on, it's stupid, right? And you're like, this is just a bunch of kids playing in this weird crypto land and they're like, they're high on drugs and whatever, right? And just put it to the side.
Right.
And I'm not saying that the Bored Ape Club is any more than what I just said, but there might be something interesting underneath it. And then you can ask yourself, what does this actually mean for me, my business, my life, you know, like the way I serve my clients, et cetera.
It's almost a mindset shift toward openness, accepting, you know, I think too often we look at something new and say, oh, well, that, like you said, that's weird. I don't really understand it. I can ignore it because it doesn't really impact what I do.
Yeah.
Versus saying, what is there about this and could it impact what I do? And mm-hmm. it's a completely different kind of state of mind, really.
Yeah. And I give you an interesting example. Another factor you can look at is what we like to call parallel worlds. So this idea of like, what do you actually see adjacent industries or behaviors which will translate into your world? I give you a simple example. If you think about the ease of use we have on our mobile phones, like the apps we're using every single day, et cetera, right? They're playful, they're colorful, they hide a lot of rather complex functionality underneath a very simple interface. Mm-hmm. And if you have grown up on this, you expect the same thing. You will expect the same thing from your business software, right? So I see teenagers today, if you put them in front of Excel, they're just baffled. You know, like, this is so ugly. I don't understand what it does. You know, like, I can't collaborate. You know, all these questions. And for me, a good example is, you know, I'm a user of QuickBooks Online, right? Mm-hmm. And you look at QBO, it's a pretty nicely designed piece of software. It's very, you know, it's very colorful. It has like graphs everywhere you want them. It's easy to understand. It's a good example for me for a company basically looking at what is happening in a parallel world, which is how do we use, you know, software today? And how can we translate this into our profession? And again, I think this is true for products, but I also think it's true for services. You know, once you're used to, for example, you get your parcel delivered within a day by, you know, Amazon and Co. Why would I wait like 2 weeks for my accountant to ship me something, right? Like a piece of paper? Like, no, I want this. Like, why can't I get it digitally right now and sign it digitally, right? Because I can do it for anything else I can do in my life.
Sure. Sure. And you can even take it beyond that, you know, good for products, good for services, good for, you know, maybe reimagining our workplaces and our workspaces and how our teams, you know, especially in this new kind of upside down world where everybody's working remotely and all that, it's a reimagining almost. Right. And I go back to this other point that you made in your talk, and this goes to kind of the difference between our core businesses and the hopeful kind of innovative stuff that we want to do on the edge, right? And you know, we're all kind of preparing ourselves for disruption and innovation and all that, and yet we all still have that core business that we're trying to protect, parts of the core that we don't want to disrupt, right? So how do we, you know, how do we do both at the same time? Kind of protect that core, kind of retreat inward, and yet still work on the edge to do kind of that important disruptive, innovative stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, clearly that's the $1 million question. Like most companies, of course, feel confronted with. Because I mean, here's the reality: you make all your business in and all your money in the core of your business, in the thing you're doing. Right. And every company needs to be good at that; otherwise, you wouldn't exist. You know, for some people, it's actually exciting to work on the stuff which is out there on the fringes, the future, right? Like implementing a new IT system, like deploying some whatever AI, thinking about what could happen on the blockchain. And you need to be careful to not lean too deep into that, because otherwise you will not look after your core business with the attention it requires. But it's also tempting to not look at it and say, well, you know, like we'll figure it out when we get there, which might be too late. So I think the interesting question here is around balance. So one thing I want to point out is, even in your core business, I think you should constantly think about how is it evolving? Because most parts of your core business, there is opportunity for you to evolve it, right? To modernize it, to put automation behind it, to simplify processes, to digitize processes, et cetera, et cetera. Very rarely will you actually have a piece of your core business where you just know it's going to be gone. Right. Mm-hmm. Like you look at it and you're like, yeah, this is going to be like in 10 years, nobody will do this anymore. So we should really not invest anything anymore. But we should clearly milk the cow as long as, you know, the cow gives us milk.
Right.
So I think from a leader's perspective, and we hear this consistently in all the interviews we're doing, all the work we're doing with our leaders, the best leaders are actually, they're pretty good at compartmentalizing both their time, their attention, but also the way they think about these businesses or these parts of their business. So the best leaders actually set aside time to think about and act on the things which are in the future. And they, you know, like I literally have leaders who say, Friday, you know, Friday is for future, right? So I spend my Fridays on the future stuff.
Right.
Or every day, you know, like when I can, like after 3 p.m., I'm going to do this, you know? So that's number one. Number two is, and this is where it gets really tricky, and you really need to be a little bit like a Jekyll and Hyde character. Because if you think about how do you measure your core business, clearly you deploy productivity metrics, right? Like anything from return on invest, margins, et cetera. So metrics which are all around efficiency, effectiveness, and optimization. On the edge where you try things out, none of those metrics make any sense because you're trying new things, you know, like the margins might not be there, the business isn't big enough, the business case isn't big enough. So if you were to deploy those metrics, you very quickly kill all the projects you do on the edge, right?
Right.
Or you wouldn't even undertake them. So you need to deploy a different set of metrics, which is a different mental model, where you really need to think about what are the experiments we're running? What is the learning we want to get out of it? How many of those experiments can we run? How can we accelerate the learnings? How do we get most learnings in the shortest amount of time? So it does require an interesting leadership model, which I think, unfortunately, I would argue to this day, we don't teach people at, you know, business schools, et cetera. So it really is an interesting world we're moving into where I think the best leaders are the ones who can and do actively live in both of these worlds, but have the ability to distinguish between them because they're different. They're very different entities.
That's really an interesting way of looking at it. I'm curious, Pascal, what disruption or transformation in the accounting and finance profession looks like to you, right? When you look ahead to the future of this profession, what do you see?
You know, the funny thing is I really can't tell you anything new here. It's basically what the profession has been talking about since, you know, we got involved with AICPA CIMA, I think in 2018-ish, mm-hmm. and have had the great fortune to work with Eric over at the AICPA, with Barry and his team, et cetera. And, you know, all of them have been talking about this for eons.
Right.
I think the big topics here, and just to reiterate this, is I think we will see a massive amount of automation. So robotic process automation, like stuff moving into the cloud, you sprinkle some machine learning or AI onto it, and these processes become much more fluid and easy and so on. And arguably, you already see this when you look at, you know, like the modern, like we talked about payroll earlier, you look at a modern platform like Gusto, for example, is a good example for me where mm-hmm. like 69, in my case, $69 a month, it's outsourced, it's done, you know, like nobody like needs to think about this stuff. It's perfect.
Right.
So that is happening. On the flip side of that, I think what is happening on the client side is, and COVID was an interesting catalyst for that, is that clients go to their account, their CPAs, and again, like myself is a good example here, and we ask them different questions. Like we don't ask them CPA questions, we ask them business questions, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's really exciting because I think the CPA practice becomes much more a trusted advisor, a financial business advisor to their clients, and can really focus on delivering value by looking at the numbers and providing a view into the business, which the business might not have otherwise. And I think that's really exciting. So in sum, I think what you'll see is effectively in the software world, there's this concept of, we call this the stack. So if you think about software, the way software is being built, the lowest level of your software is, you know, the operating system of your computer. And then you've got something like Excel on there, and then you've got your customization on it, and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen in software for 40 years is that more and more of that stack from the bottom up gets commoditized. So really the value delivery becomes higher and higher and higher on the stack, where it's really about like the specific application, the specific way to deliver the value. And I think that's happening in the profession as well. More and more and more of the, quite frankly, you know, I'm not a CPA, but I'm pretty sure there's very few CPAs out there who love entering data, you know, into a system. And all of that stuff will get, you know, more automated, easier to do, et cetera. And then really it frees up time and energy and bandwidth on to deliver services higher up in the stack. And I think the good CPA firms are seeing this as a trend and investing into moving the stack higher up and then really focusing on these value add services on the top.
Which again, just kind of reinforces that notion of learning, right? Mm-hmm. That you were saying on the edge of continually, I mean, lifelong learning beyond just CPE, but like what skills am I going to need to stay relevant going forward? So
yeah, correct. And also I think there's an interesting opportunity in terms of specialization. I think that's another thing. You see this a little bit. We were very marginally involved in the CPA Evolution project. And when you look at this, I think it's a beautiful lens on this because the CPA Evolution really is about saying, here's the foundational basis you need as a CPA. And then on top of that, you pick a specialization. So you become effectively in the learning sciences, they talk about these T-shaped people, you know, like you've got a broad basic understanding. And then there's this like narrow sliver where you're an expert, say for example, you know, cyber, ESG, whatever it is. And I do think the same will be true for firms as well. I think you will have all-purpose firms, no question, but I think those will become more and more commoditized and thinner margins, and the firms will probably get bigger simply because they need to operate on thinner margins and you need economies of scale. And then you will get more specialized firms and they say, we're specialized in a particular industry, or we're specialized in a particular, you know, accounting practice or a particular arrow where we say we're really good at ESG, for example. And I think this is exciting because it allows for really interesting work to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just talking to a partner at a firm just recently who, I mean, it just kind of blew me away. He said their specialization was kind of for-profit private schools, right? So like high schools and I thought that's that. And like, if you're talking about a niche, that's a niche for a CPA firm. And so we may be seeing more and more of that type of thing where that specialization becomes almost your differentiation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm 100% sure. And that's a really good example, by the way, for me, because what it allows the firm to do, in the case the firm you just talked about, is they become really good at this one thing. Mm-hmm. And then the interesting thing is, once you become really good at this one thing, as long as the niche is big enough, and I'm pretty sure, you know, private high schools is a fairly large enough niche, you become known for it. And when you become known for it, then, you know, like the client acquisition becomes so much easier, et cetera. And it's also, I mean, quite frankly, when you go, if you think about the sales and marketing side of things, if you go to your client and say, hey, listen, like, we're the experts in, you know, privately held high schools, mm-hmm. and we've got 20 clients already. If I'm a privately held high school and I have to choose between two firms, I would always go with the expert for sure.
Right, right. This is going to be fascinating to continue this conversation and just see where all this leads. But in the meantime, thanks, Pascal. As always, it's fascinating talking to you, and I really appreciate your time, your insights. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a really fascinating conversation. Thank you.
Oh, man, really great stuff there this week from Pascal Finette. Pascal is co-founder of Be Radical, also of EY's Wavespace Advisory Board. He's the chair of that board and a member of Pearson's Digital Advisory Board. Previously, he had held leadership positions at Google, Mozilla, and eBay. He's built technology startups and launched a venture capital firm. He is the posse leader at, I love his titles, he's the posse leader at theheretic.org and is a general upstart when it comes to creating meaningful change. He's also chair for entrepreneurship and open innovation at Singularity University, which is a global learning and innovation community that exposes exponential technologies to tackle the world's biggest challenges. You can find out more about Pascal and his work at beradicalgroup.com and also at su.org. And don't forget, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. Here we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPA. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. Phew, I'm out of breath, folks. That's it. Have a great week. We will talk to you again soon.